Just a couple of days from Rosh Hashanah. And of course, there's a great deal to say about this very powerful day. I wanted to start by raising a simple question. And that is, what exactly is our role on this day? As if to say, what is demanded of us? The background to the question is that although it's a bit of a surprise the first time you read the Machzor carefully, we don't really focus on ourselves at all that much on Rosh Hashanah. We may come to shul ready to talk about all the bad things we've done, and surprisingly, we don't talk about anything that we've done. And maybe that's for the best. The focus of the day is Malchios, Echronos, and Shofaros. And specifically, the focus is really on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that may be the best thing for us. If there's one expression that is the motif that resounds and remains with us from Rosh Hashanah, it's really the words Hashem Melech. That's what we say again and again. It's the best thing we can say. So, where does that leave us? In the relatively safe position of the ones who proclaim Hashem to be king. From a certain point of view, as long as the focus is on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we should be okay. But I believe there is a certain inner dynamic here. When we say Hashem Melech, and it's based on a comment of the Vilna Gaon, as is elaborated upon by Rav Huttner in the Pachad Yitzchak. There's a pasuk that we say, which really highlights the two words that are very similar to each other in Lashon HaKodesh when we talk about positions of kingship. Melech and Moshel. They're almost synonymous. The king, the ruler, what does the king do if not rule? But actually, the Vilna Gaon says that there's a difference between them, a key difference, for there's many different ways to rule. There is one who rules that his dominion is accepted by those that he rules. And there are others who rule by force. And in fact, this is the difference between the word Melech and Moshe. Melech represents a leader whose position has been accepted by those that he leads. The Moshel rules unilaterally, without regard for whether his leadership is wanted or not. And in fact, says the Gaon, this is the meaning of the pasuk where we say, Ki Lashem Hamlucha u'Moshel Bagoyim. For when we say Ki Lashem Hamlucha, that is our recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu as Melech and our acceptance. So for us, he is the king. U'Moshel Bagoyim. Currently, those nations of the world who are not interested in recognizing him as the one who is ruling. So his rulership over them is characterized as Moshel. We then lead into the hope for the future, which is V'hoya Hashem leMelech haKol haAretz. For currently, he is not Melech haKol haAretz. He's Melech over us and Moshel over them. For Malchus contains within it an aspect of the recognition, appreciation, and acceptance of the subjects. As indeed we say in Ma'ariv, in the bracha after Kriyat Shema, U'malchuso v'ratzon kiblu aleihem. That's endemic of Malchus, that it's b'ratzon kiblu aleihem. Now, interestingly, this distinction of the Vilna Gaon predates him, precedes him. For actually, it is to be found in one of the Rishonim, the Ibn Ezra, in his Perush on the Chumash, Parshas Vayeshev. For when Yosef has the first of his dreams that he tells his brothers with the sheaves of the wheat, so that when the brothers react, they say, Vayomu lo echav, hamaloch tim lo chaleinu, im mashol tim shalbanu, will you be king over us? Will you rule over us? Those are their words. And there, the Ibn Ezra explains, briefly as is his way, They say to him, "Hamalotim lechaleinu, do you think we will ever accept you to be our king? Imasholtim shabanu, would you be able to rule even if we don't accept you?" And the explanation of the matter is that Yosef's dream actually contains within it both elements. For originally, he says, we're all gathering sheep. The first thing that happens is, my sheep stood straight, meaning unilaterally, without any regard as to whether anyone recognized it. That's memshala. Subsequently, a later development was that the other sheaves bow down to him, which is their acceptance of him as king. Having detected these two themes, the brothers, in their negation of the veracity of the dream, said neither one will happen. Not Maloch Timloch, which is Baratzon, and not Marshal Timshal, even Shalom Baratzon. So this indeed is the template which is set down that the Vilna Gaon later on developed and echoed. What's interesting is, Rav Huttner, as he sometimes does, just as everything sounds as if the conversation is concluded, that's when he begins. We've arrived at an understanding, and we're ready more or less to move on to the next point, and Rav Huttner says, now we need to open up this question. For in the estimation of Rav Huttner, what we have just said, the distinction of Melech versus Moshel as will versus not will, it is of course correct, but in Rav Huttner's eyes, it is not the essential difference between them. It is not the actual difference between them, but rather, it is an expression of the essential difference between them. And he explains what he means. As far as Rav Huttner is concerned, the actual difference between Melech and Moshel is whether or not the king has any commonality, has any equivalency with that which he is ruling over. If he does, he's called a Melech. If he doesn't, he's called a Moshel. And what does that mean? So Rav Huttner gives a moshel, a very interesting moshel. If you ask any child, who is the king of the jungle? It's a good question. It remains a machlokas in the jungle itself, but everybody knows that the lion is the king of the jungle. Okay. Says Rav Huttner, the reason why, it's true, and in fact the Mefarshim talk about it, he is the Melech Hachayos, the king of the jungle. The reason why the lion is the king of the jungle, and is referred to that way, is because he is part of the jungle. If you could imagine, a group of people will come in, rein in order on the jungle, turn it into a hunting ground or a game reserve or something like that. And now we would ask the question, who is the king of the jungle? So if we respond, those people are the king of the jungle, so you understand there's a certain implicit insult, because in a sense what you have now equated them with the jungle, they just happen to be at the top. Whereas the truth is, the lion remains king of the jungle. They are in control of the jungle. But it would be the greatest insult to say that they are the king of the jungle. You have reduced them to nothing more than part of the jungle. They are the Moshlim. Says Rav Huttner, the reason why we say that a melech, the term melech, is only correct if the subjects accept him as king, it's because their acceptance, which is an expression of their will, is what defines them as human beings. And in fact, it's what separates them from any other living animal. Human beings have most of their faculties in common with other living beings. What distinguishes them is their das, is their understanding. And therefore, if they do not understand why he is ruling over, or why he should be the one who rules over them, and he rules over them anyway, he has ended up ruling over every aspect of them other than the one that distinguishes them from an animal. And that's why he can never be called a king, because he's not ruling over people, because the person is their das, and he never persuaded them that he should be their ruler. So he's not ruling over their das. It's very interesting to note a parallel within Rashi's Pirush on the Chumash. I wonder if this was an influence on our footnote, funneled through the Maharal. But many things, many objects are taken in the Chumash. Things are taken, people are taken. And we should note, whenever a person is taken in Chumash, and it happens quite a lot, Adam HaRishon is taken in Parshas Bereishis. Hashem took Adam and put him in Gan Eden. Avram took Sarah and took her to Eretz Canaan. Rashi, without fail, says whenever the Torah describes someone being taken in the Chumash, Rashi says he was persuaded. Lekocha bedvarim. Adam HaRishon, HaKadosh Baruch Hu took Adam, put him in Gan Eden, means he convinced him that Gan Eden is the best place for him to be. When Avram took Sarah to Eretz Canaan, he convinced her that Eretz Canaan is the best place for her to be. And in fact, we should know, we venture with caution into Unculus, of course, but Unculus actually has two different verbs for being taken, depending on whether it's an object or a person. If it's an object, the verb is nasav. But if it's a person, the verb is dabar, from the word dibur, because as Maral then explains in the Gur Aryeh, you can't take a person unless you've convinced them that that's where they should go. Because if they're not convinced, and you schlep them along anyway, you've taken everything about them except the person. Because their will and their understanding does not commit. So the person isn't taken until they're persuaded. And therefore, says Rav Huttner, that's why we say that a melech is only called a melech vis-a-vis his subjects if they agree. Because if they accept him, then he is a melech over their das, and he is a person ruling over people. That's a melech. Otherwise, he's a person ruling over beasts of the jungle. That's a Moshe. And I think these words of Rav Huttner are very profound. Not only for themselves, for the deeper insight into this explanation of the Gaon, but because I think they leave us with a great deal to think about on Rosh Hashanah. Because prior to this, for us to turn up and proclaim HaKadosh Baruch Hu as king, as melech, is easy. It demands nothing of us other than that recognition. And as long as we recognize that, we're okay. And that's largely true. But in light of the words of Rav Huttner, I think that there is an important introspection that needs to accompany us when we say Hashem is melech. For really, we need to ask ourselves, and I think it's the ultimate demand of Rosh Hashanah, to what degree am I qualified to refer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as my king? And by that we mean, if melech ultimately refers to a certain affinity, a certain equation, a certain commonalty, so I can only truthfully say that Hashem is my king, the extent to which I have made myself similar to him, which is a subtotal of everything that Torah living is about. So it's very interesting, it's very subtle. To say the words, we just have to have a machzor open to say the words. And that's a good place to be. But to be behind the words, Hashem Melech, you really need to be a godly person in order to have at least some semblance of equation between him and you, and that is, I think, a very staunch opening demand of the Aseres Yemei Tshuva. Certainly something to think about as we say those words. Now, I'd like to move from that reflection on Malchus over to shofaros, and actually to talk about the mitzvah of shofar itself for a few moments. For as we'll see, there's many aspects to it, and it's a beloved mitzvah. We perform it faithfully every year. Specifically about the sets of tkiyos in shul. As we know, we blow 30 tkiyos before musaf, and then more tkiyos during musaf, and actually, as far as the Gemara is concerned, that's it. Meaning, our minhag nowadays of blowing additional tkiyos afterwards in order to make up the 100 tkiyos is later than the Gemara. Accepted, of course, nationwide. But as far as the Gemara is concerned, the main thing is to have a set of tkiyos before Masav and a set of tkiyos during Musaf. Now, where exactly during Musaf is that is an interesting question, because according to almost all Rishonim, if you would learn through the Rambam and the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch, you'd never know that anyone says otherwise. During Musaf means the Chazan's repetition, which is what Ashkenazim do. As he finishes Malchios, there's a set, Zechronos and Shofaros, that's what it means, that's where the second set is. However, there is one of the Rishonim, and he's a very influential Rishon, he is the Aruch, Rabbi Nosson of Rome, a contemporary of Rashi, and the Aruch is the first one to mention, he refers to them as the Machmirim, in a nice way, and the Machmirim, they blow before Musaf, and then during the silent Musaf, and then again during the Chazan's repetition, and this is the first we hear of Tekiyas during the silent Amida in Musaf. He is a lone opinion amongst the Rishonim. One would not have expected anything ever to come of it, practically, except a little while later on, the Arizal, very much promoted for inner reasons, the blowing of the shofar during the silent Shemona Esrei, and of course, well, I shouldn't say of course, but it did happen, that after that, the Hasidim, almost all of them, taking their cue from the Arizal, also now it becomes minhag of most Hasidim, and many Sfaradim as well, to blow during the silent Shemona Esrei. If you go straight down the line with Shulchan Aruch and Mishneh Berurah, all you'd see is it's not advisable because it's disruptive, but that's not to be heard in those circles. So these are the two sets of Tekiyas. And the question is, where do they come from? How do they come to be? But the Gemara talks about it. And let us see what the Gemara says. And the words of the Gemara need to be considered very carefully. It begins with a question of Rabbi Yitzchak. This is in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, Daf Tet Zayin Amud Aleph. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Lama Token Barosh Hashanah. Why do we blow the shofar in Rosh Hashanah? Now, what's very interesting about what's about to happen is that it takes a while for the question to come out. I mean, this question ultimately goes through Chevlei Leda almost until the Gemara is prepared to allow the question to be expressed. The Gemara's initial reaction, Lama Token? Why do we blow the shofar? Rachmana Amartiku, the Torah says blow the shofar. That's the type of answer that you give if you don't want to talk about it, I think. In other words, here's Rabbi Yitzchak, and he's opening up the question, why do you blow the shofar? And the Gemara shuts it down. What do you mean, what type of question is that? And the Torah says, blow the shofar. Is there anything else you want to talk about? But what's very interesting is, and his question will come out in the end, but it's very interesting that the Gemara is most insistent that the first and foremost intention when we blow the shofar will remain because the Torah said. And it's very interesting to consider. I think this is the reason why the Rambam phrased things the way he did. When he talks about what the shofar is about, which he does in Hilchas Tshuva, not in Hilchas Shofar, in Hilchas Tshuva, he starts by saying, Afal pi shetkiyas ha-shofar b'Rosh Hashanah gezeiras ha-kosevho. Even though blowing the shofar ultimately is a decree from the Torah, and as we don't know, Mikomokom remez yeshbo. So he also gave this very heavy disclaimer from the outset that the ultimately we don't know, like the Gemara said. However, there are allusions, and of course the allusion is very intuitive. His allusion is it's a wake-up call. That's what it sounds like. That's what it is. And it's not difficult to relate to or to understand. But says the Rambam, but that's not what the mitzvah is all about. It's a remez of the mitzvah. But first and foremost, the Torah says to blow the shofar. However, the question is ultimately developed. Lama token emarian kashen yoshvin. Why do we blow the shofar sitting down? And when the Gemara says sitting down, it refers to before Musaf. Betoken emarian kashen omdim. Why do we blow again, standing up, meaning during Musaf? That's really ultimately the question of Rabbi Yitzchak when he was finally able to express it. And the answer is, Kidei la'arbev es ha-satan, in order to confuse and confound the satan. Now, I think this is a Gemara that we've all heard. The notion of confounding the Satan, I think, is enough to confound most of us. What exactly does it mean to confound the Satan? That we have to see. But this is the origins of the original two sets of Tekiyos, which means in the times of the Gemara, you would have two installments, after Laning, just before Musaf, and during Musaf. And the most important question to ask in order to really appreciate where the Gemara is coming from is, when the Gemara asks, how can we blow twice, really is the question. Why do we blow twice? Which of those sets does the Gemara consider to be the extra one? The one that was added in? Or to ask that backwards, if we didn't blow twice, which is the set that the Gemara insists would be the only one? Now, the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, talks about this, and he says something which I think perhaps needed to be said. Namely, says the Ran, when you look at the Gemara, and the Gemara says, why do we blow, you know, before Musaf and then again during Musaf? Why twice? Says the Ran, the intent behind the Gemara's question is, given that we're going to blow during Musaf, because that's really the way the shofar is to be blown, together with the brachos, so why do we proceed by having these, you know, the set of 30 tekiyos before Musaf? What are they doing there? That's the question, which is interesting, because it's not the way perhaps that we would have just understood, because normally whatever comes first is in, first in, last out. So what came second seems to be the extra one. Says the Ran, that's impossible. There is no way you can say that the second set of tekiyos is extra. Look upon it as redundant. That is the way shofar is meant to be blown. If you could only choose one venue, it would be in conjunction with the brachas, as the Gemara says later on. So that's the ideal way to perform the mitzvah. So if there's an extra one here, it's the earlier one. And really, therefore, the question is, why are we proceeding with this set of tekiyos before we get on with the actual mitzvah of blowing the shofar? And the answer to that is, kedei la'arbev es ha-satan. We wish to disable the satan before Musaf, because Musaf has to go through. And therefore, if the effect of the tekiyah shofar is somehow to keep forces of satan at bay, no time like the present. You want to do that before you daven Musaf, not during and not afterwards. So the Musaf should have clear passage from the outset. So we preemptively blow the shofar for that, and then we get on with actually the mitzvah blowing shofar. We should note, I think it's equally important, not only as the Ran made Seder in the Gemara for us, but he also gives an interpretation. It's not the only interpretation, but he gives an interpretation of the concept of la'arbev es ha-satan. What does it mean to confound the satan? Says the Ran, inside every person lives a satan. It's called the Yetzirah. And that's who we're looking to confound, meaning we're looking to establish order within a person and to subjugate his Yetzirah so that he'll get himself together to daven Musaf properly. It's a very interesting, it's kind of closer to home than the whatever realms we thought the satan lived in. He doesn't live that far away, and he needs to be dealt with, and that's what happens with Tekiyas Shofar. So this is the explanation of the Ran. So it's very interesting, just to summarize, to be clear, the way the Ran has explained the Gemara, it's the first set that are the extra ones. Which means that when we hear the shofar for the first time, we are hearing tekiyos that are dedicated towards dealing with the satan in order to allow us later on to fulfill the mitzvah of shofar. Now, we should be aware of implications. If this is really true, it sounds like the first 30 times we hear the shofar are not really yet fulfilling the mitzvah of shofar. We're using the shofar as a tool for a very important job, but the mitzvah of shofar, the way we really want to do it, hasn't happened yet. Which is interesting, because we do make the bracha lishmoa kol shofar straight away at the beginning. So that's an interesting relationship. Sheker deshalim v'tosav v'tivano lishmoa kol shofar. That's a bracha you make before doing a mitzvah. But the blowing of the shofar, which follows, is that really the performance of the mitzvah? That's how we wish to fulfill the mitzvah? Well, according to some, no. We should be aware, and it should make perfect sense for us in light of what we just said. There's an interesting discussion in the Gemara about Seder night. This is the Gemara in Arvei Psochim. And the Gemara discusses, I mean, you have two junctures where you eat the vegetable. Ultimately, you've got Karfas and you've got Moror. So as we all know, what do you use for Moror? Well, whatever you use. Let's say lettuce, and that's okay. What do you use for Karpas? Anything other than Moror. Because you don't want to get into trouble. So you have something else, and just a little bit, and whatever it is. Okay. So if you have your radishes, make sure they're sweet. Because if they're bitter, that's already maybe Moror. Okay. Cucumbers. Can't go wrong. Now, the Gemara does discuss the question, which is a very interesting shaila. What happens if a person only has lettuce? He doesn't have any other vegetable. What shall we do? He's stuck. Nebuch. Because the only hadama he has threatens to be moral. So there's no question that, I mean, he has to have some for a karpas. Yes, okay. But now the question is, but when does he make the bracha? So it's actually machlokas in the Gemara. But the opinion which is halachically accepted, Rav Chista, is he makes the bracha at karpas, which is strange for us because he doesn't want to fulfill the mitzvah yet until moror. But Rav Chista says, you can't eat the stuff that you're going to use for moror an hour before and not make the bracha of alachilas moror. So you make the bracha now, and then you've had some of your moror food, even for karpas, and that will see you through for when you eventually wish to fulfill the mitzvah of moror. That's a great chiddush. I mean, that's enough to scare you into buying another vegetable just to not have to deal with that. But that's the halacha. So it's an unusual situation. Says the Tosfos, looking just to reassure us, just to give us some context. Do we ever do anything like that? You do the thing, but it's not for the mitzvah yet. You make the bracha the first time because you can't do it without making the bracha some mitzvah. Says the Tosfos, actually we do it every year. That's what happens when we blow shofar, says Tosfos. We make the bracha lishmo kol shofar, but then the first 30 tekios, they're not for the mitzvah of shofar. They're karpas, essentially, of Rosh Hashanah. They are for something else. They're le'arbe v'sasotam. We're using the most powerful tool that we have. It's not an accident. But it's not yet the mitzvah of tekiyah shofar, because the mitzvah of shofar, we wish to perform the best way possible, which is the way the Chachamim said, during the repetition of Musaf. But we don't leave the bracha till then, because, like the karpas, if you've already had some, so you make the bracha before. So it's amazing to see that not only in principle do we historically look upon the earlier tekiyahs as the ones that were added in, but they actually remain extra, as if to say they remain extra to the performance of the mitzvah. They have their role, but it never encroaches on the mitzvah of shofar. It's la'arbe v'sasotan, it's to get the Jewish people ready to daven musaf, which is as valuable as one can get, but it's not yet the mitzvah of shofar. But you make the bracha already at that stage. Another example, perhaps, which is even closer to home for us, and this happens every week. The mitzvah of Kiddush on Friday night, in principle, as far as it's a Torah mitzvah, and it can be fulfilled on a Torah level in Shul. Anything you say which highlights the special nature of Shabbos is already a fulfillment of Zohar Es Yom HaShabbos Lekacha. Making Kiddush over wine, which of course adds another dimension, that's the way the Rabbanon said to make Kiddush over wine. So what's interesting is it true that when a person comes home from Shul on Friday night, he actually has already fulfilled the mitzvah of Kiddush on a Torah level in Shul, and so now he's coming to fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush derabbanan. Is that true? If it is true, by the way, it will lead to a very disturbing question, because women are chayav in Kiddush on a Torah level, even though it's time-bound because of Zohar v'Shomer. So the question is raised, how is it possible for the husband to make Kiddush for his wife? And he's fulfilled the mitzvah on a Torah level. So for he, he has only now a mitzvah of Kiddush Derabbanan. She, in the meanwhile, if she didn't go to shul, has a mitzvah of Kiddush on a Deraisa level. So she's more chayev than he is. So maybe she should make Kiddush for him?
She
make candles. Huh? Unless you say that her bracha of Lahadig Nesh or Shabbos is considered enough of a reference to Shabbos to also see her through. But this was the question that set everybody into turmoil. Without going into too many details, it is acceptable for the husband to make Kiddush for his wife, just to, I don't wish to cause any misunderstandings. But Rabbi Akiva Eger rejects the whole premise of the question to say that when he daven in shul, he fulfills the mitzvah on a Torah level. And now he comes home, he only has the mitzvah on a Drabbanon level. So to Rikiva Eger, the Rabbanon instituted Kiddush over wine because that is the best way to fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush, and therefore a person only wants to fulfill the mitzvah of Kiddush in the best way, not to chop it up into a piecemeal. And therefore there is a standing assessment of a person's will that as much as he in principle could fulfill the mitzvah if he wanted to on a Torah level, he doesn't want to. He wants to save the mitzvah, so to speak, until he can do it in the best possible way. And actually, that happens every week. And that is what happens on Rosh Hashanah, whereby we already are involved in what could count as the mitzvah of shofar. But we don't want that to be the mitzvah of shofar, as far as Tosfos is concerned, because the Chazal said the best way to fulfill the mitzvah of shofar is during the Chazan's repetition. That's over wine. So we save the mitzvah for that. And that seems to be the opinion of Tosfos. If that's true, one should have in mind, when hearing the tekiyus in the chazan's repetition, to fulfill the mitzvah, the Torah mitzvah of shofar, which is, I'm not sure that that's normally what we're conscious of at that time. However, we should know that there are numerous rishonim who do not seem to take this approach. As if to say, the Rif, Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi, when he discusses the tekiyus during the chazan's repetition. So it's interesting because what he describes as the way things were done everywhere, he has an interesting description. He says this is the way that it's done in the entire world and in the two yeshivas. The two yeshivas, of course, are Sura and Pumpadisa. They are the two central yeshivas of Baba. And if you have the entire world and those two yeshivas, you really have everything. How is it done? Basically, there would be one unit accompanying each bracha, as if to say, specifically, when the chazan finished Malchios, the first of the brachas, so they would do tekiyah, shvarim, tshuva, tekiyah. That's it. Just once. And when he finished Zichronos, tekiyah, shvarim, tekiyah. Just once. And when they finished Shofaros, tekiyah, tshuva, tekiyah. Just the one. Now, says the Rif, even though, and that's enough, even though you'd imagine that ideally one should actually do one of each for every bracha, which by the way is what we do, of course, right? As we know, if you open up a machzor, you'll see that every bracha is accompanied, each bracha is accompanied by one of each. So there's 10 sounds for each bracha. That is from the Shalom HaKadosh. But the minag in the time of the Rif was just to do just the one each time. Even though you'd imagine, wouldn't it be better to fulfill all possibilities? Maybe the true is this way, maybe the true is this way, like we did just before laning. Says the Rif, maybe it would be better. But by this stage it doesn't matter. Because you've already fulfilled the mitzvah of shofar with those first 30 sounds. So the mitzvah has been done. Of course, there remains an additional mitzvah, the Rabbanon said, to blow together with Musaf. True. But for that, it's enough to have just the one. We're no longer in doubt as to whether we fulfill the mitzvah. You certainly have before Musaf started. And this is for the additional Dinder Rabbanon. And why not do more? Says the Rif, two golden words if you have seen a Machzor of Rosh Hashanah recently, Tircha de Tzibura. It's not to keep the Tzibur in undue, for in short, for an unduly long time. Tircha de Tzibura. That's amazing. Because there's many other things that have happened since then that they didn't blow the extra tekiyos, but they do then. And in fact, that's the question of the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan reckons that the average Mishra Beirach, and he says this, it's probably longer than the additional tekiyos. But this was the original minhag, and that's those are the words of the Rif and the Rambam. Again, to put it into one sentence, minimal tekiyos during just one of each during Musa for each bracha, because the mitzvah has already been fulfilled. And of course, for us, this is mind-boggling. For we already know that the background is that originally there were no tekiyos before Musa. But they were added in La'arbe v'sasatan. They're extra. But what's most amazing is, as much as they were added in, they came second. But Lemaisa, they're done first. And there's no reason in the world not to fulfill the mitzvah of shofar through them, which we do. So they end up actually taking now the place, they are the forum of the essential mitzvah of the tekiyah of shofar. Everything else is the derabbanan din of brachas. And we, of course, are asking the question, well, why is this different than Kiddush? I think we understood very well before that there's the better way, let's use blunt terms, there's the better way to fulfill the mitzvah, and the less better way. Why not save it for the better way, which would leave the actual fulfillment during Musa? What's also interesting is that if we see the minhag that the Rif cited, it's the minhag of everywhere in his time, that for the first bracha you do shvarim teruah, tekiya. The second one you do just shvarim, and the third one teruah. Now the question is, listen, you know, brevity is really the goal here, as we said before, but it looks like you're running the expense of two of them not even being correct, because that's really why there's three sounds, right? The shvarim, maybe the teruah of the Torah is a shvarim, or maybe it's a teruah. So it's one thing not to unnecessarily elongate. But if it's a shvarim and you just did a truah because you don't want to be matriach the tzibur, but if the truah of the Torah is a truah, not a shvarim, so how can you run the risk of just doing one, you know, one type each bracha? It sounds like two of the brachas didn't really get a truah. How is that acceptable at all, even in the interest of brevity? And we should know that is why many people say that the minhag of the yeshivas is actually based on the astounding position of Rav Haigon, that in reality all variations of the truah, that is to say whether it's shavarim or truah or shavarim truah, they're all okay. They're all called truah. Different minhagim grew out. When the Torah says yom teruah, so we normally understand, and it actually seems to be the way the Gemara is expressing it, that because we weren't sure, is it a shvarim? Is it, you know, longer sounds or shorter sounds? So we just to be sure, says Rav Haigon, you can't get it wrong. Whatever you do is called a truah. The minhag, which is the famous enactment of Rabbi Avo in Caesarea to do all of them, was really just to unite all of them in minhagim. That's all. It's not just to cover all bases. It's to harmonize all the minhagim. If that's true, then by this stage, having done that and having fulfilled the actual mitzvah, so we have no problem by changing them even within the mitzvah, because you can't get it wrong. Ultimately, that's the all of that is based on the approach of Rav Haigon, even though many dispute that. But to come back to our question, why is it that we allow ourselves to fulfill the actual mitzvah first? Why not save it till the better time? So I came across what I think is the basis of an answer this morning in the writings of Rav Soloveitchik. It's based on the Rambam. For the Rambam says that in his words, when he talks about the tekiyos accompanying Musaf, this is in Perek Gimel, Halacha Zayin of Hilchos Shofar, Hatzibur chayovim lishmoa hatkiyos al seder habrachos. That's it. The tzibur has an obligation to hear the shofar again, to say the habrachos. And what that means is, and of course, when Rav Soloveitchik sees the word tzibur, that marks the tekiyos accompanying musaf as a completely different type of mitzvah. There are mitzvahs that devolve on the individual and mitzvahs that devolve on the tzibur. And if a mitzvah dwells on a tzibur, that means that an individual has no part in the mitzvah, no obligation and no fulfillment. And that's true, by the way. That's the halacha. If for some reason a person can't make it to shul, there is no notion at all of him blowing the shofar when he davens musaf, even if he's of those who would daven, who would blow during the silent amida. If you're not with a tzibur, there's no such mitzvah. So it's interesting, because now the mitzvah of shofar, these two sets of tkios, are actually in two different categories of mitzvahs. The first one is in the category of mitzvah on the yachid, and the second one is the category of mitzvah of the tzibur. And if that's true, then for each individual, there is no reason to, so to speak, hold out for the later fulfillment of the mitzvah, because that won't add anything to his fulfillment as a yachid. It's a mitzvah on the tzibur, but for each and every individual, there's no reason that they shouldn't fulfill the mitzvah straight away with these original tekiyas. And that's exactly what they do. And that is why it's not like Kiddush. Because when you're in shul on Friday night, if you wait to be yotze the mitzvah until you have a cup of wine in front of you, then this mitzvah can be done better if you just wait a little bit later. But what will happen later on in Rosh Hashanah is a different mitzvah altogether. It's a mitzvah on the tzibur, but it will add nothing to the fulfillment of the individual's mitzvah of shofar. There's nothing to hold us back from fulfilling the mitzvah straight away. And that's what we do according to the Rif and the Rambam and others. So there is a great deal of, these are some of the highlights of these mitzvahs that are so much a part of the day. The tekiyos of before Musaf, the tekiyos during Musaf, some of the classic insights and positions with regards to these tekiyos. Now, I wanted to move from this halachic discussion, really, to take a look at the bracha of shofaros. Because the more you think about it, of the three central brachas in the Musaf, shofaros is the hardest one really to fathom. Firstly, it's the hardest one to talk about, really, because the first two brachas, Malchios and Zichronos, they are ideas. They're concepts. So you only need to, you can talk ad infinitum about Malchios and also about Zichronos. Shofar is not an idea. Shofaros, it's even difficult to translate it. What would you say? It's shofar, that's what it is. It's a thing. It's an object with which you fulfill the mitzvah. But then it becomes now the subject of a bracha. And all of a sudden we start to talk about it. But it's not an idea. You need to actually develop the idea around it. Which we do. But I submit that if we look at the bracha of shofaros, we don't develop it in any way that we would have expected to. Because if anyone asks us, you know, what's shofar all about, if when we're finally allowed to give an answer to that question, you know, what is shofar all about, we'd probably say something like what the Rambam says, that it's a wake-up call, it's all of the things that, it's an alarm, it's the trumpet sound accompanying the king, it's all of those things. But lo and behold, if you look at the beginning of the bracha of shofaros, you won't find any of that. What you will find is a lengthy description of Matan Torah. Because the shofar, I think all of the psukim of shofaros in the Torah are mentioned at Har Sinai. So the opening paragraph, which is really what the bracha is all about, is a description of Har Sinai. And I'm not sure if anyone else has felt this way, but at a certain point you feel that you're not actually talking about Rosh Hashanah anymore. You're talking about Shavuos. Because that's when Har Sinai becomes the focus. Matan Torah, it is true. The shofar sound accompanied the giving of the Torah. But it does sound that we've strayed a little bit from the focus of the day. Until finally we come back. Tika b'shofar gadol l'cheruseinu. But that first paragraph, and of course, it's very difficult because Matan Torah has its own chag called Shavuos, just like Yetzias Mitzrayim as Pesach. So, to borrow the classic expression, Ma Inyan Rosh Hashanah, it's a Har Sinai. Why are we talking about Har Sinai so much? The answer, part of the answer, I think, is based on a sentiment that is voiced in the Gemara in Maseches Brachos and Daf Yud Zayin, whereby Rav Alexandria, when he used to finish his Shmonai Esrei, so we say Elokai Netzor, which is the additional prayer of Mar Baravashi. But other Amoraim said different things, and Rav Alexandri used to say the following. It's a short tefillah, I think it's well known. He would say, Ribono Shel Olam, Galui V'Yadu Lefanecha, Sheretzoneinu Lasas Ritzonecha. You know that our inner will is to do your will. The continuation of the tefillah is, Umi Ma'akev, right? Stop. What stops us from doing that? Su'or She'be'isa, the yeast and the dough, which is the Yetzirah, V'Shibud Malchus, and the subjugation of the kingdoms. And of course, there's a great deal to talk about those two impediments. But the essential theme that comes out is really the enduring theme of the day. Namely, the identification of the inner identification of us with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will. That is the goal of Rosh Hashanah. To present ourselves and to identify ourselves as being in line with the world the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants it to be. And what's interesting is, that explains many of the tefillahs that we have on Rosh Hashanah, which are, again, not about us, but they're about how we'd like the world to look. And of course, it's very similar to how HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants the world to look. Awareness of God in the world, appreciation of the Jewish people in the world, appreciation of tzaddikim in the world, that those are the three uvechens. Uvechen ten pachtecha, uvechen ten kovad la'amecha, uvechen tzaddikim yismuchu v'yiro. What are we doing with those tefillahs? It's the best thing we can do on Rosh Hashanah. We are aligning ourselves with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's vision of the world. Because really, Ritzoneinu la'asos Ritzonecha, and it's probably the most effective way of dealing with the year behind us on Yom HaDin. Because if we start to take blow by blow everything that we've done, so first of all, the day isn't long enough, and I'm not sure how far we'd get. That will have to happen. And Yom Kippur, this is a prelude to Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, that's what happens. We focus on, you know, the year behind us. But on Rosh Hashanah, if we set our identity more than anything else, it will determine the way that everything that we've done is viewed. Because however many good things we've done, if we are essentially good people, is reckoned as an essential expression of who we are. And if we've done anything bad, as long as we're prepared to identify ourselves and to move away in terms of an identification with those things, it makes a pivotal difference in terms of whether they're considered to be a true expression of who we are and what we really meant at the time. Where does this come from, this nature, which has halachic implications? The notion that the inner will of the Jew is to do the right thing is a halacha. It's a famous halacha in the Rambam. Sometimes a person doesn't want to do what he needs to do, and you need his consent. So you beat him until he consents. Kofinoso, achiyoma rotsani. Says the Rambam, if he could finish a sentence himself, rotsani, what do you think he would say? He'd probably say, rotsani, that you shouldn't be beating me. So what type of consent is that? But the Rambam says, in Hilchos Geirushin Perek Beis Halacha Kaf, he really wants to do the right thing. It took a while to beat it out of him. But really what you're beating back is Yetzer Hara. Those are the words of the Rambam. Until you finally get to him, that's halachically binding. Where does it come from? So the light goes on in this matter with the Meshech Chochma in Parshas Vayera. Because according to the Meshech Chochma, the source, right, what embedded this inner will of the Jewish people to identify with the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, was the Akedah Yitzchak. The Akedah, when Yitzchak, and of course all of the genetic heredity comes spiritually as well from the Avos, when Avram and Yitzchak together are prepared to give up really everything, in every sense of the word, to go through with the Akedah, so that embeds within Yitzchak the absolute nature of he will do anything. He'll do whatever HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants, that's what he'll do. Completely negating his own will. Now that's the Madrega of Yitzchak. But it became the inner Madrega. That is the legacy of the Akedah. And that is why we've mentioned in the past the Baruch of Zichronos, which is an extreme funnel, the very wide angle. Because it starts by saying, Ata zocher maaseh olam, you remember everything. 10 minutes later, it ends up by saying, please remember just this one thing, which is the Akedah. The Akedah is Yitzchak Lezara Hayom Barachem in Tisko. Remember the Akedah. So I think that's really where Jewish chutzpah comes from. Here we are, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you can remember everything, but we'd like you just to remember one thing and actually not remember anything else. Just remember the Akedah and we'll be okay. Now the question is, of course, we understand there's certain things that whatever it means, we want HaKadosh Baruch Hu to forget. And there's certain things we want him to remember. But the question is, only one thing? I mean, no one told us that we had to be so picky. Only one thing? Avraham Avinu had no other sechuyos. Yaakov isn't even mentioned. I don't know this is a time for us to feel that we can, you know, we don't wish to take on additional zechuyos because we probably, you know, we want to travel light in the bracha of zechronos. Who told us that we could afford to be so confident? I would imagine, leave out everything negative, bring in everything positive. So you don't talk about the Akedah, talk about Zechus Avos generally. Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Can't hurt, can only help. And at that point, we need all the help we can get. So why do we focus on Akedah Yitzchak to the exclusion even of other Zechus Avos? Why don't we want credit from anything else? But the answer is, we're not mentioning the Akedah at the end of Zechronis in order to get credit for his great deed. It's not about cashing in on Zechus Avos. We would have probably mentioned many other things. But rather, we mention specifically, remember the Akedah for Yitzhak's descendants as an expression of what our true identity is. That's what we wish to be remembered here. Not just to garner in additional credit. But what does it say about who we are? Because that is our greatest achievement. That is our central goal on Musaf of Rosh Hashanah, to define ourselves, ultimately identify ourselves with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will. And that really is the role of the shofar. As the Mefarshim tell us, as surely as the shofar takes its form, as it's an expression of something that comes out from inside a person. So this, the characteristic of the shofar, the segula of the shofar, is an expression of the inner essence of the Jew. That's what it is, if it could be expressed. And that's why the shofar has such a central role on Rosh Hashanah, because it's a way of bringing out into some form of expression who we are, because that's how we wish to be seen. Now this alignment of expression between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it reached its peak in the Akedah. It became embodied in Yitzhak in the Akedah. But historically, it actually preceded him, and ultimately it followed him. It preceded him in the form of Adam HaRishon. For Adam HaRishon, the way he was created was also, and he was given initially this madrega, as the pasuk says in Koheles, "Asher asah Elokim as Adam Yashar v'heimo bichu cheshbonus rabim." HaKadosh Baruch Hu made Adam HaRishon Yashar. That means his initial inclination was to do the right thing. How there was an interface to do the wrong thing is now a very complicated question. Let's enter the Nachash. But initially, he has this inclination, this inner drive, and in fact, it represents him totally, to do Ritzon Hashem. And that's why the Yom HaDin for us is actually the day of his creation. I mean, the first of Tishrei is the day of the creation of man, not of the world. Because it is the anniversary of the one day in the year that Adam HaRishon existed in that way that we're looking to bring out within ourselves. So we're looking to tap into that quality, the pre-chet quality. Now when he fell, as a result of his chet, so good and evil get mixed up together, and so they remain, until, says the Gemara, until Har Sinai. And at Har Sinai, everything reverted. It was very, very close for the Jewish people to get back to that madrega of Adam HaRishon. And that is expressed in the words Naaseh V'Nishma. Naaseh V'Nishma are the Jewish people saying, of course, it's impossible to do anything before you've heard. So to say we will do before we hear means the answer is yes. Whatever you want of us, the answer is yes. Because Ritzoneinu La'aseh Ritzonecha. And therefore, to put it in our terminology, what Matan Torah represents, what Har Sinai represents, is the Jewish people really rising to the level of the Akedah. They are attaining the level that was instilled, right, bringing out within them what is ultimately the Jewish nature given to them by the Akedah. And that is why the Torah says that the giving of the Torah and standing at Har Sinai was accompanied by the sound of a shofar. That is the connection between the shofar and Har Sinai. Because the shofar, as an external expression of the inner will of the Jewish people, was exactly what was being achieved at that time when they were able to say Nasa v'nishma. It was a shofar moment. Or, to put it differently, it was an Akedah moment. It was a national Akedah moment. And indeed, Chazal tell us that the shofar that was blown at Har Sinai was taken from the ram that was offered at the time of the Akedah. Because it's the Jewish people are tapping in and really rising to that level for that time of the Akedah. And that, I think, is why the Bracha of Shofaros begins by describing Har Sinai. Not as the basis of Matan Torah, for that we have Shavuos, but as a historical recognition of the level that we're looking to express on Rosh Hashanah. We had it at Har Sinai, the beginning of Shofaros. And that's why the mitzvah of the day is actually Lishmoa Kol Shofar. As much as we talk about the mitzvah to blow the shofar, but the bracha is Lishmoa Kol Shofar, because ultimately we'll appreciate it's more important for us to hear what we sound like than for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to hear. If we hear it, then of course he'll hear it. But he's not going to hear it without us. We need to be behind what it represents and plan the year accordingly. And I'll finish with something very interesting. We spoke about the confounding of the Satan. How is he confounded? Well, the Yerushalmi says that there is a shofar that will be blown. I mean, that's the Tkav Shofar God L'Chayroseinu, to announce the Geula. And therefore, says the Yerushalmi, when we blow the first head of the Tkias, so the Satan, who's the Shtikle Tamen Chacham, so he knows, listen, he hears the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, say, okay, Jews are doing mitzvahs. All right, it's not the first time, not the last time. But when he hears the shofar being blown again, he gets nervous. Because they've already done the mitzvah, and they're blowing again. This could be something else, and he gets all flustered, and that's la'arbe v'sasatan. So says the Yerushalmi. Now I have a simple question on this Yerushalmi. The Satan is meant to be much smarter than we are. In fact, he is, because we're smart, and he can outsmart us. So for a smart being, he seems to make the same mistake every year. Because that means he certainly didn't learn the Yerushalmi. And apart from anything else, just experience. He's been around certainly longer than us. He should realize by now that he shouldn't take it to heart. So why is he so smart? He makes the same mistake every year. My friends, I think what the Yerushalmi is telling us is that the Satan does not make the same mistake every year. He's actually right every year. And we are the ones that make the same mistake every year. Because no one appreciates the potential of what the shofar represents about the Jewish people more than the Satan. So he hears the mitzvah and he hears it again and he says, this could be the geula. This could be it. And he's right. And we're wrong. Because we could learn a thing or two from him about the power of the shofar and what it should be setting up. And therefore we hope that we don't need to go that much longer without repeating our own mistake for thousands of years. And when we hear the shofar and we're prepared to present ourselves and what it represents, present ourselves as people as part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's picture, looking to see the world the way he wants it to, then maybe it will be on the way to the shofar HaGadol, which Chazal tell us is the second horn from the ram of Akedas Yitzhak, because that's when the Jewish people once again will rise to that occasion. We hope that it will be soon. I wish you all a kasiva, chasima tova, shana tova.